This week, President Joe Biden talks Ukraine and the Middle East in Germany.
We think that there's a possibility of working for a ceasefire in Lebanon, and it's going to be harder in Gaza, but we agree that there has to be an outcome.
North Korea sends troops to fight with Russia in Ukraine.
Ukrainian officials released video of what they said were North Korean forces at a training ground in Russia, distributing equipment as they prepared for deployment.
And now that Israel has killed the architect of the October 7th attack by Hamas, is this an opportunity to end the war?
Join us on the Voice of America as we explore the issues in the news.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lori London in Washington.
And I'm Scott Walterman.
U.S. President Joe Biden met with allies in Germany on Friday in what could be his last trip to Europe as the U.S. president, with the upcoming presidential election casting a long shadow over the visit. He urged allies to continue supporting Ukraine.
There's unanimity on continuing to support what's going on in Ukraine, helping Ukrainians.
Speaking to reporters on the tarmac before departing, Biden said his meetings Friday in Berlin with the leaders of France, Germany, and Britain also included discussions on the way forward to ending the Middle East conflict following the killing of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar in Gaza.
There's an opportunity, in my view, and my colleagues agree, that we can probably deal with Israel and Iran in a way that is ends the conflict.
What comes next is uncertain. The Israeli Defense Force announced they had killed Sinwar, who was the mastermind of the October 7th attack and the number one target of Israel's year-long retaliatory campaign in Gaza. VOA's White House bureau chief, Patsy Wida Kuswara, has that part of the story.
For years, as Hamas top leader in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar built up the militant group's military capabilities. Since the U.S. designated terror group's attack on Israel on October 7, 2023, Sinwar has been hiding in tunnels like this one. But on Thursday, Israel said they killed Sinwar in an operation in South Gaza. They released a video showing what they said was his final moments. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu:
to the people of Gaza, I have a simple message. This war can end tomorrow. It can end if Hamas lays down its arms and returns our hostages.
President Joe Biden was en route to Germany when the news broke. He called Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to congratulate him on getting Sinwar.
Now is the time to move on. Move on, move toward a ceasefire in Gaza. Make sure that we move in the direction that we're going to be in a position to make things better for the whole world.
Israel's military campaign has targeted Hamas leadership, but has also killed tens of thousands of Palestinian civilians. Biden's call to end the fighting was reiterated by his vice president, Kamala Harris.
It must end such that Israel is secure, the hostages are released, the suffering in Gaza ends, and the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
Families of Israeli hostages still held by Hamas say Sinwar's killing brings more urgency for a ceasefire deal. Orna Nutra, mother of Israeli-American hostage Omer Nutra:
their lives are in great danger now, more than ever. We're calling on the Israeli government and the U.S. administration to act swiftly and do whatever is needed to reach a deal with the captors.
But despite increased pressure on the Netanyahu government, ending fighting in Gaza may not be Israel's main focus right now. Political analyst from Bar-Ilan University, Jonathan Rinhold, via Skype:
Israel's focus and America's focus is in Lebanon because there's opened up an opportunity to weaken Hezbollah greatly. And this is something that all the American allies in the region, Saudi Arabia, Egypt, etc., are very interested in.
Battered by a year of Israel's military campaign, Gazans say Sinwar's death will unlikely end the year-long war. As Israel hunts down Hamas militants, UN experts say over 1.8 million people, almost 90% of Gaza's population, are experiencing crisis levels of hunger. The findings come after the Biden administration warned this week that U.S. military aid might be cut off unless Israel addresses the humanitarian needs in Gaza. Supplies were airdropped over Gaza Thursday. UN officials said aid has been critically low since Israel's renewed offensive in North Gaza cut off lifelines there. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Washington.
For analysis on what this could mean for the war in Gaza, we spoke with Boaz Otzili, professor of foreign policy and global security at American University's School of International Service.
Thank you so much for being able to join us and talk about this.
Sure. Thank you very much for having me.
Let's start with who he was, who he is. How did he rise through the ranks of Hamas?
Sinwar has been a Hamas member for a very long time. He spent quite a few years in the Israeli prison for previous operations he did. And I think part of his rising in terms of power in Hamas probably been done in the Israeli prison. But then he was released in the previous hostage release deal, and he rise through the ranks, and he's been very brutal for both Israelis, but also inside. So in order to get to be a top commander in Hamas, you have to be brutal to get your way out there. And so he was brutal to the Palestinians in Gaza as well.
He was also apparently the mastermind of the October 7th terror attacks, which started this situation. And apparently he's really the one that has not been openly ready to make a deal for a hostage release ceasefire deal, that he's ruthless and uncompromising from what we're hearing. What would it mean for the hostages still in Gaza and the future of this war in Gaza?
Right, yes. He is the mastermind of the October 7th attack. As you know, my cousin was killed on that attack, and his body is still in Gaza. So that's my personal connection to that. We don't quite know if he definitely was tough in negotiation. We don't quite know that he was not interested in a deal. He was interested in a deal, I believe, that fits his conditions, and that is to end the war completely, that the IDF will withdraw from the Gaza Strip, that a certain number of large number of Palestinian prisoners will be released. And the other thing that he demanded, that Hamas will still have some power in Gaza. So that's, I think, the opening is that right now, with all of what Sinwar was, I think the main obstacle to a deal like that was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. But now Netanyahu has a chance to basically declare victory. All of the high-ranking Hamas leaders have been killed. Many thousands of Hamas fighters have been killed, along with many other non-combatants, of course. The Gaza Strip is completely ruined. Probably 90% of the houses there are no longer standing. So Netanyahu can declare that this is the ultimate victory that he was trying to get, that all of the aims of the war have been achieved, with the one exception, and that is releasing the hostages.
What about the people of Gaza? They, as you pointed out earlier, didn't like Sinwar because he was so brutal to the Palestinian people. How does his death impact the population there?
It's really hard to tell because there are very few ways to credibly poll the Palestinians in Gaza. The indicators that there was a very low support for Hamas before the war. After October 7, this support for sure went up. But by now, when they kind of realize how bad this was for them, I want to believe that the people of Gaza probably some of them are happy with the death of Sinwar, even though they might not be kind of courageous enough to say it. But I want to believe that they want an end to that tragedy, and they want some arrangement that will promise to them a light at the end of the tunnel as well.
Where would this leave Hamas? Is it decimated as far as leadership goes, given his role?
I think, you know, whenever a leader of a terrorist organization is assassinated, it kind of depends on the terrorist organization itself. But Hamas, we have to remember, Hamas had strong leaders before, and they've been killed by Israel, assassinated, and other leaders came. And that will happen for sure with Hamas. It is a very well-structured organization. It was not dependent on Sinwar. It existed before Sinwar, and it will exist after Sinwar.
Thank you so much for the time and the perspective.
Thank you so much.
Boaz Atzili, Professor of Foreign Policy and Global Security at American University's School of International Service.
You're listening to Issues in the News. I'm Scott Walterman with Lori London. South Korea's spy agency said Friday that North Korea has sent troops to support Russia against Ukraine. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden joins us now for details.
First off, just tell us what we know so far.
Well, there have been reports circulating for days, if not longer, about this increased cooperation between North Korea and Russia, specifically with North Korea helping Russia in its war against Ukraine. And on Friday, South Korea's National Intelligence Service, its spy agency, said that North Korea sent 1,500 troops from its special forces to Russia earlier this month. There are plans to send more in the works, and that these troops are now training in Russia's Far East for deployment on the front lines against Ukraine eventually. The South Korean spy agency said that they identified these forces by using facial recognition software boosted by artificial intelligence, and they said that their information indicates that these North Korean special forces are now being equipped with Russian uniforms, gear, and IDs. On top of that, Friday, Ukrainian officials released video of what they said were North Korean forces at a training ground in Russia, distributing equipment as they prepared for deployment. The United States, long aware of cooperation between North Korea and Russia, told VOA that it is concerned. The White House said it's concerned, and it said that if this information is true, if these allegations and this intelligence from South Korea and Ukraine bears out, it would, quote, mark a significant increase in the relationship between North Korea and Russia.
What did the United States say about the reason that, if anything, the reason that they're sending the troops?
Well, U.S. officials have long spoken about Russia's tactics as it prosecutes its war against Ukraine. Earlier this month, U.S. defense officials and military officials talked about how they estimate the Russian forces have suffered about 600,000 casualties. 600,000 casualties, that includes killed and wounded, since Moscow first launched its invasion back in February 2022. They said that number surpasses the casualty toll of any conflict that Russia was involved in since World War II. Other defense and military officials have described Russian tactics as basically sending soldiers into a meat grinder to just try to overwhelm Ukrainian forces with sheer numbers, no matter the casualties and the deaths suffered by Russia's own forces. So what U.S. officials are now telling us is that, again, if this information bears out, that North Korea is now sending special forces and perhaps other soldiers to help fight in Ukraine, that this could be seen really as an act of desperation. One official said it was a new level of desperation for Russia and just shows how it continues to suffer these significant casualties. Another U.S. official that we spoke with said that not only has the casualty rate for Russia been bad, but it's been especially bad over the last several months. This official saying that Russia's averaging more than 1,200 casualties each day, specifically suffering high casualty rates in its fighting in eastern Ukraine and in Kursk.
If it's happening because Russia is losing so many soldiers, which would mean that it's potentially in a weak position regarding troop size, and it adds all of these North Korean troops into its force against Ukraine, would that put this war in a much more dangerous position for Ukraine? And would allies need to change their support strategy?
That's one of the big questions, what impact this type of move, especially if it gets bigger, if we see more North Korean forces being sent to Russia to fight in Ukraine, what impact is that going to have on the battlefield? Already, Western intelligence agencies have seen what impact some of the North Korean supplies and equipment have had. The U.S. Defense Intelligence Agency earlier this year showed how Russia was using North Korean-made missiles to hit targets in Ukraine, specifically using them to launch an attack on Kharkiv in Ukraine earlier this year. That's had some impact. North Korea is known to have helped them get enough munitions and supply munitions, though Western officials also note Russia has ramped up its production of artillery, ammunition, munitions, rockets, and is able to produce more now and send that to the front line. So what impact is a big question. There's also an impact of, in terms of not just the numbers, but in terms of quality. How good are these North Korean special forces? And then if they are good, can they make an impact? Can they be force multipliers? Or are they, even though they're North Korean special forces, are they not battle-hardened enough to really make any significant difference on the battlefield? These are questions that intelligence officials both in the U.S., in South Korea, and elsewhere in Europe are looking at right now to try to figure out where everything goes from here.
Hmm. Jeff Selden, VOA's national security correspondent, thanks for the info.
Anytime.
For further analysis on this development is Naoko Aoki, a political scientist at RAND Corporation who specializes in East Asian security issues.
Thank you so much for joining us to talk about this.
Of course.
So if this is true, and North Korea is sending troops now to fight with Russian soldiers in Ukraine, tell us about the change this would mean for North Korea on the world stage and with its relationship with Russia.
Sure. So I think this at this point, it's pretty credible because the South Korean National Intelligence Service confirmed that there were 1,500 North Korean Special Forces troops that were sent to Russia for training, and they will be deployed in the battlefield later. So what this means, it's very notable for a couple of reasons, one of which is that this is confirms the strong cooperation between North Korea and Russia, which follows the signing of a strategic cooperation agreement earlier this year. It's not only North Korea is not only sending weapons anymore, it is sending its own people. So this is really notable for North Korea, which has not really participated in a major way in an international war. It has sent weapons. It has sold weapons and missiles in the past to other countries, but this is a different level of commitment. And there are a couple of things that North Korea stands to gain from this. One is combat experience, because North Korean troops, there are a lot of North Korean troops, actually. North Korea has like the fourth largest active duty troops in the world, but they are not, they don't have combat experience. This will give them combat experience. So this is one of the things that North Korea stands to gain. North Korea is also sending weapons to Russia, as we know, and that is also good for North Korea in a lot of ways, meaning they can have technical data if it's used in, it is used in combat. And they get data from that, and that could lead to more clients. I will note two other issues that North Korea stands to gain, and one is that over the short term, cooperation with Russia can be useful for Russia, for North Korea, particularly if it involves things like advanced technology. North Korea, for example, has been trying to put more military satellites and military reconnaissance satellites in space. They said that they did one last year, but they have been struggling since then. Another area where North Korea stands to gain from stronger ties with Russia is over the longer term, because North Korea's strategic objective is, of course, the survival of the Kim regime and maintaining an increasing influence on the Korean Peninsula. So if North Korea could help with that, that would be a great gain for North Korea.
Does this put South Korea in a more dangerous situation?
Yeah, I will answer that in a two-part way. This complicates things for everybody. North Korea does not have the kind of influence, or at least now commitment, that will dramatically change the conflict itself in Ukraine. But it really complicates the situation in a lot of ways. I mean, you know, is this another party to the war? What if North Korean soldiers are killed or captured? How do we deal with that? So those are some of the questions. And this is especially problematic perhaps for South Korea, because South Korea has been talking about sending weapons directly to Ukraine. It may motivate South Korea to do that. We saw a little bit of the debate being motivated by North Korea and Russia's strategic cooperation agreement in June. But on the other hand, if South Korean government sends weapons to that are used in Ukraine, and that ends up killing North Korean soldiers, what does that mean? So South Korea is in a very difficult position in a way.
Does it make North Korea stronger because they've been so isolationist? This is really a big step for them, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's a big change for us as well. This has been happening gradually, but we're so used to, we meaning the United States and its allies, have been used to, I think, thinking of North Korea as an isolated country, an outcast, an underdeveloped country with nuclear weapons. Well, now I think we have to think of it as the threat from North Korea as more than that, because it's not just North Korea alone. We have to think of the threat that it poses in terms of how it can collaborate and cooperate with countries like Russia and possibly China.
Does the European, the Euro-Atlantic community, and the world, of course, in the U.S., have any leverage on how to respond, and what should some sort of reaction be?
So that's another difficult question. On the diplomatic stage, as we know, the UN Security Council is dysfunctional because, well, the two permanent members, Russia and China, can veto any kind of resolution of the UNSC. So other groupings, like the group of G7, for example, is important, but I think it's becoming more important, increasingly important for other countries, including the Global South, to collectively say that this is unacceptable.
On a global scale, since you bring up the Global South and China, this continued relationship that's building between China and North Korea and Russia, you know, BRICS just started. China's working really hard to build a global footprint. Talk about how the three countries, China, North Korea, and Russia, are sort of assembling this alternate to the West.
Yeah, so I would say that Russia and North Korea's cooperation, particularly when it comes to defense, is, as we've seen from this news, is very, very close. Not quite. China is not quite in the collaboration in the way that North Korea is with Russia at the moment. That does not mean that China is not sympathetic to Russia's cause. It clearly is, and it is helping Russia economically. But I think I see a little bit of a difference there. That does not mean that the threat is any less, however. And I think the China's vision of trying to kind of collaborate with countries and making countries see their way is also is problematic for the United States and its allies.
Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. We really appreciate your insights.
No problem.
Naoko Aoki, a political scientist at RAND who specializes in East Asian security issues.
And that wraps up our show this week. On behalf of all of us here at VOA, we thank you so much for listening.
For more news throughout the week, listen to The Issue on our website. Just Google VOA The Issue.
Join us next week for more Issues in the News. Until then, I'm Lori London.
And I'm Scott Walterman.